You're listening to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast, a product of the Oregon Basketball Coaches Association. To learn more, visit our website at or.nhsbca.org. Welcome to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. I'm Derek Duman, OBCA President and Boys Basketball Coach at West Albany High School. Today, I'm joined by Joel Sabatka, former boys basketball coach at Valley Catholic High School. Coach, how are you doing today?
Doing great, Derek. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time. And I guess I should note, Coach, at Valley Catholic most recently, but also the head coach at Portland State back in the day. So let's jump in with kind of your basketball history. How did you get involved in the game, and how did you end up becoming the head boys basketball coach at Valley Catholic?
Well, you know, I look back, and it started actually even in the middle school and high school. I had some incredible mentors back then who would even ask me out of middle school. PE teacher asked me, I've ever thought about being a basketball coach. And at the time I thought, well, heck no, I'm going to play. But, you know, I was fortunate to become an undergraduate student manager at Arizona State, worked for an incredible staff there. And then my first job out of college was at Eastern Oregon, 1993. I worked for Art Furman, who I think has one of the most incredible coaching trees in the Northwest and West Coast, a guy that really promotes his former players and coaches and helps them to move on. And spent two seasons there over in the Grand. I went back to Arizona State as a graduate assistant. And then when Portland State started up their program back in 96 and went Division I, was hired as an assistant and took over as a head coach in 1998. Was there for 4 years as a head coach, then was at Cal State Northridge for 3 years as an assistant, and then ended up at University of Portland for 6 years working for Eric Reveneau, and then one day just got a phone call from the principal at Valley and was looking for an athletic director and a boys basketball coach, and it happened to be at a time when, you know, I was sort of thinking about what might be next for me. I'd been a Division I head coach and knew the amazing opportunity I had at that point. And it was really difficult. And I love coaching the game, and it didn't really matter at what level, and made the decision and spent 9 years at Valley and just really, really enjoyed it. So it was pretty cool.
You know, what were some of the biggest differences from being at the college level? Cause you were there for a long time, 20 plus years. And then to jump to the high school level, probably very, very different for you. What were kind of some of the big changes that you had to go through as a coach with that change?
Well, I think obviously the time, you know, the time commitment as far as what your players and your program, and, you know, at Valley, we needed kids to play multiple sports. We encouraged that, and that was big for us. Whereas Portland, you know, or at Northridge or Portland State, those kids are coming on a basketball scholarship. They're there for school and basketball, you know, and that's the amount of time you have with them is different than what you get in high school as far as practice time, film, just all those things. So you have to adjust, you know, and we've had kids at Valley that weren't basketball first type players. They might be a football player first, and you need those kids to help you win basketball games. And so figuring that out, I think early at Valley Catholic was really important for me. Is not everybody is a Division I basketball player or a college basketball player, but what are the strengths of each of those kids and how can they help your program win? Even the kids that don't play a whole lot, how can they help as a great teammate and understanding that? So I think understanding that these kids are all going on to different careers and college paths and how can you help them succeed in those ways? And I think sharing that experience of being on a program and a team like that can help all the kids, even, you know, the ones that aren't going on that are just going to school or that type of thing.
You became a head coach at Portland State at a pretty young age. I think at that time you were the youngest Division I head coach in the country. What were some of the key lessons you learned as a young head coach, and how did those lessons kind of impact the rest of your coaching career?
Well, I think the biggest lesson, and I actually, you know, I was named the interim head coach at first, and I remember going down to a recruiting event, and I talked to Steve Lavin, who had been the interim head coach at UCLA, and you know, the biggest thing was just being myself. You know, the team had supported me to become the head coach for who I was, the relationships we had, my knowledge of the game, my preparation, my work ethic. that didn't need to change, you know, who I was. I wasn't going to, you know, become the head coach and completely change who I was. I think they understood that. Obviously, the job is very different, but just being yourself. And I think you find your voice as a coach throughout your career. I can remember coaching camps when I was in college and summer camps and coaching 10 and 11 year olds in games and treating it like I was coaching, and I was trying to find, how do I motivate these kids? Who's my best player? I got to give him a shot, or, you know, or whatever. And, but just finding your voice as a coach, and that voice can grow and mature, but you don't just change because you to someone else. I think that's when players can see through that and lose respect. And I think our players appreciated that at Portland State, that I was still who I was. Yes, I was now the head coach, but none of the other stuff that they appreciated about me was going to change. And I think, you know, what it taught me, you know, as I went on, was how important those an assistant coach is. And just that, you know, when I became an assistant coach again, I had such a greater appreciation for what a head coach goes through and how, you know, a great assistant coach, a great manager who stay one step ahead of that head coach and make his job more efficient. That's what you want. You don't want an assistant or somebody else that's making the head coach's job more complicated. You want to make his, help simplify his job and be able to be there. And I think having sat in that seat for 4 years just really helped me later as an assistant coach when I worked for some great head coaches, but just to be able to offer that and actually have known, okay, that's what that feels like.
With all your time at the college level, you know, you had a lot of experience in recruiting, probably at various levels, Eastern Oregon, NAIA, Cal State Northridge, WCC at the University of Portland. What are some things that you learned maybe in the recruiting process that are things that could help high school coaches that have kids that want to play at the next level?
You know, one thing I would suggest is just to get to know your players. I think as they come in, I mean, obviously we know, you know, if kids are pretty good, you know, have a feel like that kid, you know, might be a kid that could play at the next level or have a chance to play in college, but finding out if kids want that, especially early on, and kids may not know that. They may be a late developer and it may come to them later, but just understanding what their goals are and then being realistic with them is like, okay, if this is where you want to go, or I think you have this opportunity, but we've got to match that with the work and the development if you're going to reach that. I think developing relationships with college coaches, college programs, local and afar, but whether that's sending out a game schedule, practice schedule each year to an assistant coach that you've gotten to know, maybe it's to a clinic, maybe it's just the local coaches. College coaches appreciate that communication and maybe an update. Hey, I got a couple guys that, you know, might be on your radar that if you get a chance to see us, or send some film or a link to some film, even summer stuff. You know, if you know you've got a really good player, a good player that's playing AAU, and you know his summer schedule, where he's playing, when he's playing, and you've got a relationship with a college coach, send that out to him so that they know, they get him on their list where they can go and see him. Anything that can help simplify that job for that college coach is going to help your program, you know, and college programs love to recruit great, successful high school programs. They like great culture because all those things translate when you go to the next level, when they come from a program where, you know, you work on all those things. Another plus I think I had the ability to do is take a high school kid, or you have a couple kids or three or four kids that are thinking about playing, take them to a college practice. Take them to a game, but take them to a practice. Let them see what that's like. Let them see what the weight training session's like if you develop that relationship, because I think that opens some eyes too to see like, wow, this is next level, you know. But if this is, that's where I want to be, I want to be there. Or if you go to a game, hey, I want to play at this level. And then you have those kids thinking about that, and then hopefully the work, you know, they put in to get to that point. But I think anything like that where you can be proactive with your program and let programs know, you know, about practice times and things like that. Even social media now, I think, is really a great way to get the word out to other programs. Or if you have a kid that's, you know, looking to play back east, or if he has family in a certain area and there's a certain academic school, or, you know, he's identified a few schools, reaching out to those schools and letting them know, you know, and it's not like you're telling them, hey, this kid has to play for you, but it's like, hey, I've got a kid I think you should take a look at. And I think all coaches respect that and want to take a look at that and want to know about that, because you can't see everybody. You really can't.
Right. what are some ways maybe that high school coaches could build those connections with college coaches? You talked about, you know, maybe you know someone that you've built a connection with. Maybe someone that's either new to Oregon or newly a head coach or just hasn't had a lot of experience with those connections. What are a few things that high school coaches could do to build those connections?
I'd say one of the first ways is attending a team camp or a team tournament in the summer. You know, I go back to days at Portland State when I would run our team tournament, team camp, you know, in 96, 98. You know, back in then, I mean, I've met coaches, Pat Coons, you know, Nick Robertson, Chuck Matthews, Tom Johnson. You start thinking about people that I met over 25 years ago that I still have relationships with because they came to our tournament. You have time to watch those teams. You have time to talk. You have a coach's social. A lot of times the program will do a clinic, and they'll just do a chalk talk. And those are where those relationships start. And it's like, hey, coach, can I stay in touch with you? What's your email? Or if you go to a clinic, most often in clinics I've been to, the presenter will say, hey, here's my email. Do you got any questions? You want any of this stuff? Send it to me. You know, send me an email, you know, ask for it. And I think that just that interaction of, you know, going to watch a college practice, you know, reaching out to a school, not everybody might allow that, but a lot of programs are love to have high school coaches come, and just sitting and watching and seeing why or ask questions. Why do you do this? And I think then you start to really get a feel for that program or that coach or what they're looking for. And there's a mutual respect level there that I think, you know, you're not going to call that college coach about someone that for sure can't play at that level. But, you know, when you do have someone that might be an opportunity or a recruit or prospect for them, you want to let them know. And I think the coaches appreciate that.
At Valley Catholic, you also got to serve as the athletic director. And so I kind of want to change gears a little bit here. And talk about, even as a head coach, how you developed your assistants, and as an AD, how you developed your coaches to improve their craft. What are some things that you did or that we can do as coaches to help bring our assistants along if they want to make the jump to the next level or the higher chair, I guess. Chair at the end of the bench.
Right. Well, I think you just said it right there, is knowing that. You know, I think asking your coaches, you know, if you're fortunate to have a staff that's been with you, or if you're a new head coach and you're hiring a staff, is get to know what your coaches' goals are. You know, do they want to be a head high school coach? Do they want to get to the college level at some point? And just understanding that some coaches, hey, I'd like to be your varsity assistant. You know, I'm okay not being a head coach. That's great too. But, you know, finding out what their aspirations are. And then, you know, I think a head coach touches every aspect of a program, especially in high school. You're still involved in some way with every single aspect of the program. So I think assistant coaches need to know that. If it's just somebody that has coached the defense, you know, it's like, okay, well, you know, let's take a look at this. Maybe we need to give you some different responsibilities. Or as an assistant coach, I think you need to ask. If that's your goal to be a head coach, you got to know every angle of the program, whether it's fundraising, whether it's summer, whether it's academics, whether, you know, it's practice planning and doing those types of things. And, you know, one way I've seen some coaches, and we've done it at a necessity one summer, is maybe an assistant coach takes over as a head coach for a summer game or a summer tournament. He gets the head coach kind of, you know, maybe he's there, but he's not there, but the head coach gets that opportunity to find his voice. You have to find that voice, and you know this, Derek, you've been at different levels and different places, but you have to find your voice as a head coach. And that's different than when you're sitting there as an assistant, maybe, you know, with a clipboard or play cards or things like that. You've got to be able to have that voice, and you develop it and practice it. You know, in practice, you develop it when you're scrimmaging. Maybe you split up and you're doing two teams, and the head coach officiates, and each assistant takes a team and gets to be the head coach for that. And when I was at Portland State, I worked for Richie McKay, and I'll never forget, he said, whatever assignment or responsibility you have, you're the head coach in that area. So I remember being in charge of camp, and he's like, you're the head coach of camp. He said, I want everything that comes out of our office and our program about camp to be, you know, you're the head coach. You make sure that it's the way you'd want it to be if you're the head coach and represent our program. And I think that's a great way to look at it. It doesn't matter if it could be putting the baskets down, sweeping the floor, getting the balls out, you know, whatever it may be, equipment, you know, all those things help run your program, help it run smoothly. And if you have all those constant hiccups, interruptions, things like that, it doesn't go well. But I think as an assistant, you've got to ask. You got to say, hey, coach, you know, how do you do this? Or what do you use for this? Or, you know, how do you prepare for practice? How do you, when you watch film, what do you look for? You know, and I think an assistant coach that has that desire to be a head coach should be proactive in that way. But I think that as head coaches, we need to know, you know, you can't just assume, oh, he doesn't want to be head coach. Or maybe it means, you know, going coaching the JV game, being the head coach, and then being on the varsity bench rather than just being an assistant the whole time and offering suggestions. Maybe it means calling timeouts. Maybe it means making substitutions, dealing with officials. All those things help you grow that voice, and it's really necessary rather than you get it the first time you get that opportunity, you know.
Mm-hmm. As an AD, you also got an opportunity to hire new coaches. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's probably listeners that maybe will be applying for head coaching jobs. Obviously, not right now, but, you know, when the springtime comes around, or assistants that are going to look to do that. What are some either suggestions or things that you looked for as an athletic director during the interview process that might help coaches land that job?
Well, I think as an athletic director, I wanted somebody that was genuine and was a fit for our school. You know, you get a little leery if somebody's applying for 10 different jobs. And I know it's different if you really need a job and you're trying to get it. But I really felt I could feel from a candidate if they thought our school was a special place and they felt this was where they wanted to build a program or, you know, continue on the tradition of a program. And they knew it wasn't they were going to come for 6 months and then look for something better and be gone. Because I think as an athletic director, you don't want to go through it. You want to hire great coaches and you hope that they stick. I mean, a lot of times if you hire a great coach, he may get a better opportunity, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's a credit to you and the coach. But I think, you know, if we find someone and we feel like we're in a great situation and we provide those resources, we'd like that person to build that program and continue to build it. So I think making sure that you personalize your interview and your pursuit of that job, get to know that school, get to know that program, that community. Those kids, you know, when you go in to meet or interview with an AD or with a committee, have your homework done. Know something about the program. Be in depth with where you would take that program, but also understand where they're at. If you go in and say, we're going to do this, this, and this, and it has no, you know, real no bearing on where they're at or their community, I think that's probably a turnoff. But I think if you get in there and you understand and you can show that, and I think also, one thing that was really big for me was where you were working. Is that head coach? Is he someone that's calling me and saying, you need to hire this person? This person's ready. Or, you know, places you've been. I always think it's important to work for great people. I learned that after being in Eastern Oregon. It never is about the level, but it's about the people and that you're around and where you work and the type of person that can pick up the phone and call and say, hey, this is someone you need to take a look at. I believe in this person and I have great respect for that person already that's calling me. Then I'm going to definitely, that's going to change things for me. I'm going to take a harder look at that person. So, you know, it gets back to, like everyone says, do the best job in the role that you have, where you're at. Be the head coach there, be a superstar there, and that will take care of it. If you've got one foot out the door, or if you're dissatisfied with, you know, your current responsibilities and you're not doing the job that is helping the program where you are currently, it's hard for that other person to recommend you wholeheartedly and say, hey, you need that person's ready. You need to have that person on your staff.
For sure. I'm going to tap into your memory bank here. At the end of an interview, usually the athletic director asks if there are any questions from the candidate. I'm curious if you can remember the best question a candidate has ever asked you.
Wow. You know, I think a couple that struck me that I thought were important was, what are the expectations of this program? And I think when you think about that, you know, you it's easy just to get caught up and think win losses. But I don't think that's the answer. You know, program growth, obviously competitiveness, and student athlete development, I think is our most important role that we achieve and responsibility. So I think that question, you know, to understand that, you know, you might be walking into a program that's won back-to-back state championships, and what are the expectations? Maybe that athletic director said our expectation is to compete for a state championship. Okay, what does that mean? You know, what does that mean, that I got to be in the state championship game this year coming? You know, but understanding, you know, what those expectations are of the program, and, you know, getting a full understanding of the full model of the school, like developing, you know, these young men and women, and making sure that they, you know, are growing as people. I mean, what's the percentage of students that are going to move on and play in college is pretty small. So are we developing these young men and women for life and life skills, and making sure that, you know, everybody's on the same page in that regard.
Yeah. It's good. It's a good one. As we get ready for this upcoming season, Coach, you know, you were coaching last year, pandemic season. It was all out of whack, super wonky. I think a lot of coaches are a little nervous or maybe even excited about getting back to, quote-unquote, normal. But with that, we're going to have to kind of reteach our expectations, our culture, how, you know, we do the things we do within our program. So I'm curious, if you were going into this season as a head coach, how would you be preparing for that, you know, reset of things going into the year?
Well, it's a great question. And I think everyone that went through last season knows, you know, not being in person for so long, not seeing our students, the shortened seasons, the lack of practice time, I thought was really a big one for me. But I know personally, I just had a greater appreciation for the opportunity to coach and teach and be in the gym with your players and coaches and everyone enjoying basketball. You know, our preparation obviously was cut down. You're sort of just jump right in and play, and you kind of feel like a lot of us was like, oh my gosh, we're just going out there and we haven't worked on this, and we have, you know, you sort of got past that, I think, or at least I did, and just appreciated that we're back out here. You know, look at the smiles on faces. Look at these kids working hard together and, you know, celebrating together or fight through adversity together. That's what it's about, you know. And I'm always big on that's where I'd start. I'd start with the gratefulness of just enjoying the opportunity, just being back playing again, being back together, competing in practice, you know. When you think about something that's taken away from you, getting it back, maybe it's not as important that our footwork is exactly right every single time. You know, we get caught up in a lot of the details and worrying about a lot of those things, when boy, the gratefulness of being back playing and being together is such an important thing. I think keeping that kind of at the center of you know, what we're thinking about each day, rather than the stress and the worry about not getting to cover something else, but always remembering that, you know, we're grateful that we're back. And I'm always big on, you know, reading and, you know, coaching leadership books. I love to find quotes. I find quotes everywhere and like to save them. And I would share them with our teams and our players. But I saw one yesterday, and I was thinking about you, and I thought it'd be great to share. It was from the Arizona newspaper, and it was from a Hall of Fame coach down there, Sam Ballard, who he just stepped down as the head coach at Mesa Community College. And he was asked about coaching, and I thought his answer was just so spot on. And it's everything I've believed since I got into coaching. And I think at this point, with kind of that question, it sort of sums that up. And he just said, I just love to coach basketball because I saw it as life in a bottle. Every aspect of living was included. What kind of person you are matters. There was always too much to learn, so you never stopped. Loyalty to a cause was paramount. You had to be self-disciplined with academics and punctuality. You made relationships that lasted a lifetime, and the game has an incredible window for building skills. And I think when you ask that about expectations, like, to me, that sort of sums it up. Yeah, there's going to be, you know, we run a man or zone. Did we set the screen? Did we not? Did we switch when we were supposed to switch? You know, all those things come into play. But just being out there and those types of things and playing hard and playing together, that really is where I think the expectations would start with me.
Good stuff, Coach. We're going to take a quick break. We'll return with more from Coach Sabatka right after this on the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast.
Coaches, as you prepare for the upcoming season, don't forget to renew your OBCA membership. Membership includes access to exclusive resources from high school coaches across the country, as well as access to Lucio Sports Technology, the same technology used by NBA franchises. Membership starts at just $15. Don't delay. Renew your OBCA membership today.
Welcome back to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. Derek Duman here with Coach Joel Sabatka. Coach, I'm going to jump into some more X and O basketball-specific stuff in this second segment. I want to start with talking about practice. If I were to come watch your practice, what would I see? What would I hear? What would I feel if I, when I was in the gym watching your team compete?
Well, my hope is that you'd hear lots of positive energy, lots of communication, the sound of a team and coaches working together and working hard. You know, I think we all sort of know that sound when we go into a gym. It's different than a quiet gym, just an energy, you know, people pulling for each other, picking each other up, and a lot of teaching, but a lot of people working. And I think that's to me what you hope when I was in college and I'd go watch a high school practice, you just walk away, you know, you're feeling motivated, feeling like your fire's burning because you just watched that practice and how inspiring it was and how hard those people worked and how prepared they were and how the practice went together and the kids competed, the kids support each other, but they got after it, you know.
How did you go about preparing for practice? Do you have a specific format that you use? Did it depend on, you know, the day or what happened the previous game? What did your plan look like and how did you prepare for that?
Well, I think the big thing for me, especially with a lot going on as an athletic director, but I always try to find a quiet space to kind of think about practice that day before that day. Hopefully it wasn't, my day didn't get away from me, but in the morning, night before, and I would just try to think what's the team need today? You know, what do we need? What's the feel of our, what's the vibe of our team right now? Do they need energy? Do they need picked up? Do we need to get after it? Do we need to compete a little bit more? Do we, you know, and then that you're not only thinking about your whole team, but individual players. And I'd like to ask my coaches, you know, what do you guys think? What's something we need to do today? You know, we're struggling with this, or, you know, what's a drill? What do you guys think? Or even letting an assistant write up prep. Send me what you would do for the bulk of this practice, you know, and ask them. You know, I think lineups as well. Like, I think, you know, hey, maybe we need to mix some things up. Ask your assistant, what would you do? If you were the head coach, who would you start, or what group would you, who would be your first person in? And, but then, you know, I just tried to then, based on the time amount that we had, we obviously had standard things we did to start practice with pre-practice and warm up. And, you know, we'd do a focus piece where I would give a quote and kind of talk about announcements, get that out of the way. Like, okay, tomorrow we're doing this or we're departing at this time. And then get into it, you know, whether it be kind of get things going with competitive drills, try to work on situations. I'm like a lot of 5-on-0 to make sure we knew what we were doing and putting in different things or making game adjustments to make sure everybody understood and we got through that and everybody had a chance to run through things. And then maybe at the end, say time for going over a scout and different things we're going to do there. But you might break down the scout, you know, prior in the drill and then bring it all together at the end and say, okay, this is what they're going to run. This is what we call it. And let's go through it. Everybody's had a chance to guard it and talk about it. Any questions? And then a lot of times we would go in, if we had an earlier practice, we'd go straight in and watch film and try to bring those things together. Okay, let's take a look at it on film. This is what we were talking about. Or if we had the later practice time, we'd watch film, you know, right before practice and then go in and recreate it, on the floor and try to teach in different methods and make sure kids understood. And, you know, everybody learns differently, I think. And some kids really pick it up on film. They really can understand that. So I think just really, you know, each day trying to find that space to think about what my team needs. I've been in programs where we did practice plans for a week or 2 weeks out, you know, and it was sort of a very regimented thing. But I found for myself that there's things that, you know, I might need to stay with something a little bit longer, you know, or I might need to get off it and we'll come back to it tomorrow and that kind of thing. And, or just finding out, you know, based on how you're playing or what's going on, maybe we need to put some more time into passing, you know, or we need to get more shots, things like that. And just being able to make those decisions for your day and maximize the amount of time that I know we're all under a crunch to be in the gym. So you got to maximize that time.
Yeah. What do you think is the best thing you do as a coach?
Wow. You know, I've always felt I had a pretty good understanding of just finding a strategy, sets, actions, both ends of the floor that kind of fit our personnel, you know, and then teaching that to the team. I see a lot of different stuff. I like to steal from everybody, and I'll see things and think, boy, I think so-and-so on our program would be really good. He's similar to that kind of player. That'd be really good for them. Or if we ran it this way, get so-and-so a shot coming this way, you know, and just kind of having that feel. And I actually, it goes back to even when I played, I felt like even as a high school player, like I felt I kind of had that, you know, understanding of the game where a coach would kind of say, okay, you call the defense, or, you know, here's what they're going to run, and you switch out on something, or you understand, you see an open player and you throw it to him. And I think I see that in a lot in kids when I watch kids play. I notice that almost first, and I notice kids that compete, but I notice kids that have a great feel for the game and have their head up. And but just understanding that, I think, is something I feel like I've done well, that just to be able to put in something that fits our group and get them to buy in and understand it and then execute it. I think that's our greatest challenge as coaches, is we could run anything we want, but can they execute it? Will they execute it? And did they execute it? You know.
Did you find maybe at Valley, or even at the college level, it's a little different, obviously, but, you know, when you're doing that, you're finding those sets or things. Did you find that kids were able to pick that up okay, or did you find struggles with maybe if you did one thing the year before and then you're going to change it to the next year? Did you feel like kids adapted to that okay, or did you have to take extra time? And I think sometimes coaches are worried to change things because of how long it's going to take to learn them. So I'm just curious on your experience with that and how that worked.
No, definitely. I think you got to be careful. I like to tinker, and you can get a little bit, almost feel like everybody should see things as you see it. But I also felt like we didn't have the same personnel. There were things we did every year, the same actions that we did every single year that we kept. But I think it's important as a coach to have something that you can go to when needed, that your kids know we'll get this shot, or at worst, we'll get to the foul line, or this is going to work for us. And they have your back. It gives them confidence. It's one thing to, you know, I know there's coaches that have systems, and that's the system they've run every year. And I think you get really good at teaching that. And if you can teach that at a lower level coming up, I think that can be really good, especially the younger they are, that they pick things up and they know those things and simplify it in that way. But I also think that some point somewhere, somebody's going to have something that stops that. So what's your answer at that point, rather than, hey, that's just what we do, and if you stop it, you beat us. I always feel like even if I hadn't shown the kids that, I have notes that say, okay, if they go to this, we're going to look at this. I may not even have worked on it. You know, we may have not even talked about it, but in my mind, I have those kind of like what ifs if during a game, to be able to make those adjustments.
At Valley, I know, and I know less a little bit at the college level or at Portland State, and you had a lot of success with some zone defenses, 2-3 zone, and even a 1-3-1. I'm curious, is your kind of philosophy behind that? Do you see yourself as a zone guy, or was that a personnel-based thing? And maybe what were some of the specific key teaching points that you taught within your zone defense?
Well, it's funny. I think that was one of the big things I needed to adjust to when I got to high school. We always seem to have size in our program, which is a blessing, but I had to adjust to the high school game when I first got there, and with no shot clock, and a lot of teams that typically didn't have size that might be playing five guards, you know, and running five out dribble drive and ball screens, you're going to play man defense and have to put big kids in positions that they're not going to be successful if you want to play man to man. And it's unfortunate, but that's sort of the way it was. And for us, to distort the game and give our kids an advantage, we sort of put in some different zones. And when I was at Cal State Northridge, I worked for Bobby Braswell, who was incredible head coach and played multiple defenses. And one of the ones that played was a 1-3-1. And one thing I learned from him was you sort of disrupt the game. You know, you have to prepare for that. Like when I was at Portland State coaching against him at Northridge, we had to work on, you know, four or five things that he was going to show. And if he found one that was working, he was going to stay with it. And so, you know, we didn't run that many, but it just having something different that you didn't see, and also to allow us to have that size in the game, whether it was, you know, a 2-3 extended zone or a 1-3-1, and keep that big person and give them a chance to compete in that and maybe take you away from what you're really good at, which is five out and ball screens and dribble drive. And then, you know, we prepared our zones just like, you know, I would do with man. I mean, we work on slides, rotations, communication. We would scout, and this is what they're going to do with it. And we would break down drills, you know, throughout practice, and then we'd bring it together and we'd have one group working that sort of thing. And it helped us to go against zones. I think offensively it was good for us, but it also built that. Now, you've still got to be able to play man and then defense. And there were times we had to do that and develop what coverage you're going to use on ball screens. But I just felt like with no shot clock and putting people in position to just drive at you and having a hard time if a guy fouls a guy, and next thing you know, you're in the bonus and they're shooting free throws. And, you know, we really tried to take away that and not foul people, make you make tough shots, and then be able to maybe create some offense from our defense, create turnovers and get easy baskets because of how we were playing with our length and, you know, kind of a trapping style.
Did you feel like it was difficult or maybe more difficult when you had to play a team that played all man, right? So I'm thinking, like, if you have a two-hour practice, you're going to spend a lot of your defensive time maybe working on zones. But then when you get into the game, right, or even you're going through your offensive stuff, whether it's 5-on-0 or against defense, you're going against man-to-man. Did you think that was more difficult because you played more zone, or did the kid, were the kids able to adapt? Did it seem to matter at all?
No, I think we still spent that time, you know, where we'd send an offensive session where we would work against man. I mean, we had, I thought, you know, opportunities to do that. I think it was more, you know, when you do have size and you're playing maybe against somebody that doesn't, is handling pressure. So it might become more of a full court situation where offensively can we handle that pressure. But then, you know, even from a half court set, you know, okay, this is what we're going to do. And sometimes you'd see those teams would end up in a zone because we were able to utilize our size advantage inside, you know, so we might see the zone come back at us because we were able to do that. So I think being really balanced, I think, is good. I, you know, we probably, you know, saw more pressure at times against teams that gave us a little bit of trouble was just that extreme pressure. But I don't know if that's, you know, just, it's tough to duplicate that in practice too, as well.
Yeah. How did you know, or maybe there's no rule, but it was a gut feeling, how did you know when to get out of the zone?
I think for me, when you're giving up easy baskets, you know, if people, I could tell, was around, especially our 1-3-1, long enough to know that, okay, if you know, I remember being at Northridge and we played Vanderbilt and they diced it up like 3-4 possessions in a row, and we just sort of looked at each other and said, uh-oh, like they kind of have it figured out. And so, you know, I think, you know, there's times, and I, you know, one of the things, you know, Derek, I saw when I was a student manager, we played Arizona when I was at Arizona State, Lute Olson, unbelievable coach, but he would change defense. He would go make miss. He would go make zone, miss man. And I've done that a lot through my career, even as a college coach and a high school coach, and just keeping people off balance and out of rhythm, making people think, you know, there were times we were in our 2-3 and people thought we were in our 1-3-1. And the difference in college and high school is when you have a shot clock on you, you better adjust pretty quickly. But, you know, even in high school, keeping that balance, out of a timeout, changing, you know, just to give them a different look. You know they called timeout because they're thinking about that, what defense you were in. Okay, let's switch, you know, and not getting too outthinking things. But I could tell when it was time. And I had assistants that knew that too and say, Coach, we need to think about, you know, change it. And you get a feel. I think you do, whether it's zone, man, or whatever zone it is. Like when somebody has a really good strategy or they have a good player, like, you know, even a 2-3 zone at the high post, if someone's, you know, we were going to give up some shots from the high post, contested, but if all of a sudden they're driving you and they're getting to the rim or they're hitting three after three after three, you know, okay, let's switch, let's get them off balance. You know, we played, you probably remember, played Gonzaga and we're up, I think, 19-3 at one point at home, jumped all over them. Gonzaga went zone at the end of the first half. And at Portland, we had some of the best shooters ever, and they just were able to we got stagnant, I thought, like, and they were able to match up with us and got back in the game. And that was the difference in that game was, you know, so I think it can be anything. It can just sort of be a rhythm change of somebody to, you know, to maybe, you know, they get a couple buckets in a row. Okay, let's give them a different look and see, you know.
Yeah.
So ignoring last spring and our COVID season, what is typical game preparation look like? And probably specifically at the high school level, obviously it's different. You noted, you know, at the college level, you have more time and kids are on scholarship, so you can do a little more of that. But what does your typical game prep look like at Valley Catholic in preparing for upcoming games over the course of the week?
Well, I think in high school, you try to take the basics of what we did in college or what I did in college and bring that to the high school level, but I think significantly simplify it is the best way to put it. I had a scouting book as a head coach when I would go watch somebody or I'd watch film, and I would have keys that I would put down in the scouting book, sets, out of bounds plays, personnel, and I would make notes. And then even from those notes, I would simplify that for what the team might get. And maybe it's two things on each kid. And maybe it's their, what do they do? You know, what are they going to be the keys? Are they going to press? You know, if we're a pressing team, what's their press offense? What are they going to run against zone? What are they going to run against man? Identifying their best players, best shooters. And I think that's what we're all trying to do as coaches is give our kids an advantage when they walk out there. It doesn't have to be a textbook and so where they're bogged down with information. But if somebody's better going left than right or right than left, or if somebody can really shoot it or really can't shoot it, or in the post they like to turn over their right shoulder and not their left shoulder. Like I always felt as an assistant coach even preparing that I was doing my job if I was able to find something for our team or one of those players to help them, to give them advantage. I always felt the worst feeling in the world when you were given a report on a kid. And it's still to this day, I tell kids as far as becoming a complete player, but if you have to tell somebody to play that person straight up because they can shoot it, they can drive it both ways, they can score in the post with either hand, you know, if you have to tell them, hey, look, play straight up, you feel like you're waving the white flag a little bit, like, hey, I can't really tell you. But if you're able to say, hey, I've watched film and he goes right 90% of the time, you know, you got to sit on that hand, or they can, we cannot let him take a three, you know, and you get that kind of mindset, but really trying to simplify it for your guys. And if you can get calls, I was fortunate to have really good assistants at Valley that would go and scout teams and get film. And I felt like if I could watch the film and try to give our guys, even in college, some preparation. Now, people are going to change and add new things, and you're not going to know those things. But, you know, is your defense and your rules, in a sense, good enough that you can make those adjustments? And if they do change, then you can make the adjustment, you know, to match that, you know.
How much time did you spend working on maybe like offensive actions or maybe defensive things that the other team would run versus the other team's personnel?
Probably more on actions. We would talk through personnel, whether it be in a meeting room before we watch film. Assistant coach or myself would go through and maybe highlight some things about key players and then watch film. We used to watch film more as like a chunk, kind of a live, you know, watch some game flow, and then we might find those sets that we were going to cover on the floor that we did cover. We'd find some actions to go over. But I think, you know, and then on the floor, you know, trying to make sure, I think the challenge can be, depending on how many people you play, is that everybody goes through something. If you're going to guard it a certain way, that's why I think there's times where rules can take over. If you switch everything, that you just switch everything. You don't care what they run in that sense. But I do think it's nice to be able to give your guys a heads up, that, hey, we've walked through this. We've talked it, you know, and when they start to run it and I'm calling it out, you kind of come back to what we did in practice for a day or 2 days, and you know you need to be here and you need to get through this. And I think just, you know, giving that adequate time. I think you can go a little bit overboard where, you know, you could spend all the time and they may not run that, you know. So you got to, I think you got to, you know, be you know, judicious with how much time you're going to spend on them, and then what time you need to spend on you, you know.
Right. Did you give your players, like, a physical scouting reports, or was it digital, or what did that look like?
No, we really didn't. We would go up on the board, and then what we did is we had notebooks, and I would give the guys kind of a blank pages, and I'm big on them writing it down. So we would talk about personnel, and they would write down personnel. Then I would put some keys, offensive and defensive keys, and then actions and things that we're going to see. And then I would have them, and we would kind of hold their notebooks, and then every time we would meet, we'd bring it. Guys would grab a pen, grab a notebook, and they would take the notes themselves, and they could refer back to them. But I really thought it was helpful to have them write it down than me just to hand them, and the time consumption as well as typing up something or getting something put together. Sometimes if there was an action that I wanted them to see, I might write it up and then copy it. But I like to go on the board and show them and then really talk. And I think for me, just seeing that look in their eyes, you know, in a classroom, and they listen with their eyes, and you can tell, and you can almost tell when someone's not getting it, you know, and you can ask, you know, hey, do you understand this? You got this. What are we doing here? And you can ask some questions, but them writing those notes down. And it was kind of their notebook throughout the year, whether we had a guest speaker come in, they could take notes, listen to that guest speaker, whether it was we were talking about core values, anything like that. It was kind of their book for the year, their binder.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about film studies and some of the stuff you did with that. You know, Huddle has really improved in terms of basketball. And I know at the college level, you used some higher tech stat programs and things of that with Synergy. But I'm curious, like, how did you utilize Huddle within your program? What did film look like? And maybe what kind of statistics or analytics did you use to kind of gauge where you were as a team and maybe how players were performing?
Well, you're right about Huddle. I think Huddle has just taken off, and, you know, they bought Sports Tech, which was the company we used when we were at Portland and Portland State even, and even Northridge to cut film. But, like, to have Huddle Assist now, which we were fortunate to have at Valley, you can go back and be so efficient in watching your games and the actions and just so many different things, not only as a team but individually, you know. And I would always look at the four factors and see where we were, you know, from a defensive effective field goal percentage, offensive turnover percentage, rebound percentage, and just look at some of those numbers, but also just the shot charts were incredible to see. And I think for our guys, encouraging them to get to learn how valuable and how easy and just helpful it is to watch film. Film doesn't lie. And for your guys, you know, to sit with somebody, I remember sitting with somebody who was in a shooting slump, who was a great shooter, and watching every shot that they took, you know, watch all the makes, watch, is there anything you're doing different? You know, look at your feet, look at, you know, are you rushed? Is it a good shot? If it's a good shot, you're going to keep shooting it. Or, hey, is this a shot we want to take? You know, and I think that's where, just like if you're in the gym and you remember this as a manager and they're rebounding for someone, your relationship with that person, when you're in there working and sweating with someone, that's how you develop and grow that relationship, that trust. And I think the same thing can apply when you spend some time watching film, whether it's with that individual, whether it's with a position group. But, you know, just being able to look at those things. And I didn't make a lot of necessarily edits, if you will, on Huddle, but being able to sit and watch our stuff and execution and being able to then say, okay, hey, we need to take a look at this, you know, and good stuff too. I think you got to watch both. It's not always about showing them what they didn't do, but I think especially something that somebody's been working on, like, I love stopping something when someone sets a great screen or makes a great execution play, or even defensively they execute, and you show that and recognize that person. Everyone's going to cheer for the guy that makes the basket, but, you know, the guy that, you know, made multiple efforts and set screens and ran the floor and you know, made the assist and dribbled to the right spot to get the pass, you know, all those things, or got the deflection, dove on the floor. Like, I think film can be so valuable in just recognizing greatness in that sense across the board, not just, hey, this guy had 5 threes or whatever, you know, we don't need to watch. How did he get that layup? Well, he got the layup because we executed the play and we set a great screen and he got a layup. You know, yes, he made the layup. That's awesome. But let's look at all the things that happened prior to that and going back and seeing that. And there's times where I think you need, as coaches, you need to go back and watch too, because you don't remember everything. But it's like, I got to, you know, or a kid will say, hey, I think I did that. Yeah, you were right. You were in the right spot. You know, it just was, this happened. So I think film, as a group, as a team, I think we'd encourage our players to look themselves, you know, and you can find out, Huddle will let you know who's watching. But I think, kids getting an understanding of, you know, we'd put scout film up there and ask them to watch who they're going to be going against. Hey, what do you, and I'd have guys come to me and say, hey, I was watching, you know, 22 on, you know, that team, and he really likes to do this. And it's something that maybe I didn't see, you know, and it's amazing when you just get kids, that interaction is really fun.
Were there any stats that you had assistants keep during games that you wanted to know either at halftime or between quarters, to give you an inclination of how things were going?
Well, defensively, I always felt deflections was a big one, especially if we were our 1-3-1, because typically a deflection can lead to a steal, which for us led to layups. And I really felt like if we were playing really hard and being really active, anticipating, but just really with incredible effort, I thought deflections were one that was going to come, you know, and then another one that defensively was if we were giving up offensive rebounds, because, you know, I think when you're giving up offensive rebounds, if you're giving up layups, you know, point blank type layups, and even free throws, when you're giving up uncontested baskets, I think you're going to have a hard time. You're going to have to score a lot of points. You want to make things tough, and if they're hitting tough shots, or they're challenged contested shots, hey, you know, they've made these, but hey, they've gotten X amount of points or this many offensive rebounds, and they've had, you know, six layups. You know, those are hard. Those are high percentage. You know, most high school players can make a layup. So, you know, what can you do differently? And then offensively, I felt like, you know, there were times where we had great shooters. We'd get great run, great offense, get great shots, and sometimes you don't knock them down. So I wasn't as caught up with shooting percentage. If we were taking quality shots and doing that, it sometimes was more the turnovers. And especially when turnovers led to kind of outlets and uncontested layups, again, that turnover leads to you know, really harming your defense. And you can't really get your defense set to get a stop and defend when they're running out getting those types of shots. So I think making sure that those – understanding where are we at with turnovers and you know, those kind of unforced turnovers.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take another break. When we return, Coach Sabaka will try to beat the shot clock here on the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast.
The Oregon Basketball Coaches Association is excited to announce the Central Oregon Regional Youth Coaches Clinic. The clinic will be held on Sunday, November 7th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. at Summit High School in Bend, Oregon. If interested, please find our registration page at or.nhsbca.org.
Welcome back to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. We're talking with Joel Sabatka, former boys basketball coach at Valley Catholic High School. Coach, for my next set of questions, I'm going to put 35 seconds on a timer, a.k.a. a shot clock, and I'm going to ask you some rapid-fire questions. They should have 1 to 2 word answers, and we're going to see how many questions you can get through in that 35 seconds. Sound good?
Sound good. Let's go.
All righty. Shot clock is starting now. Should Oregon High School basketball have a shot clock?
Yes.
Should it be implemented at the sub-varsity levels?
I would say varsity 6A, 5A to start.
If you're up 3 points with less than 10 seconds, do you foul?
Less than 5.
What's your favorite way to guard on-ball screens?
Trap.
Do you think the high school three-point line should be moved back?
No.
What's your favorite sports movie?
Hoosiers.
What's one word officials would use to describe you?
Persistent.
Time. Very good. That was good possession, Coach. Well done. Well done.
Thank you.
I like persistent, too, because it doesn't have a negative nor a positive connotation, right? So I think that's good.
No.
I like that. Yeah. It's good. So it's neutral position.
You're there, right?
Yeah,
they know
exactly.
You're there.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You didn't ask me, though, what my favorite drill was, and I was going to tell you that my favorite drill, it all depends on if I have a manager that can go left or right with the dribble, because if he does, then we're going to do some high on-ball shooting if I have that.
Okay, that's good. That's good. I like that. I like that. Coach, I want to give you a chance. You know, obviously, shot clock is a pretty big deal in high school basketball. Some states have it. A lot of states don't. And then NFHS recently came out and is giving states the opportunity to choose now, starting in the 22-23 school year. You mentioned you're in favor of the shot clock. Can you elaborate on why?
Well, I've seen it on both ends. You know, I've seen it as an administrator and as a coach. I've coached against it and obviously in college with it. And then we went up to Washington a few years ago at Valley Catholic and played a game with the shot clock. And, you know, as a basketball coach, I'm for it. I understand there's concern administrators with costs and with personnel. But I got to imagine if other states can do it, we can do it. You know, and I look at it, you know, when I look at football, not all high school football is the same. You know, there's 8-man, there's 11-man. Football's got a shot clock, if you will, as a play clock. Volleyball has a clock. You know, you look at all these other sports, and I think from my standpoint in Oregon and where we're at, I could definitely see, at least at the 6A and 5A levels, maybe as varsity to start, but I could see those schools having no trouble to implement that. And I think it would be great for the game. I think if you can teach someone to not score, you could teach them to score. And I know that there's can be talent issues, but I think that, you know, there's times where, you know, I've been on the side where we've had more talent and someone's held the ball and they got less possessions to score. We held them and then we scored and then it kind of became detrimental. I don't think you see that a lot where it works out that way. I think it's more exciting for the kids. I think obviously the fans, but I think it teaches the kids how to play, you know, how to work and attack, if you will. So I'm in favor of it. I think it could start that way. And I think that's a great opportunity to see how it works and then maybe other levels can adapt and if they see that success. But, you know, we do have to get, you know, as an AD, I remember, you know, we had to hire for volleyball a scoreboard operator, scorebook person, and a libero tracker. So, you know, if I can find those people for a volleyball match, why can't I find those people for a basketball game?
No. Coach, you've been to a lot of gyms, recruiting, coaching, kind of all over the Northwest, Arizona, all over the country even. It might be hard to pinpoint one thing, but I'm curious, what's the strangest thing you've seen in a basketball gym?
Wow. I don't know if it's the strangest, but there's been, basketball's been so amazing for me and taking me different places. But I know one place I always think about is coaching at Stanford, and you're coaching, you're on the floor, and all of a sudden the crowd gets into the game, student section, packed Maples Pavilion, and the floor starts to shake. And you're thinking to yourself, like, okay, we're going against, you know, three all Pac-10 players on the other side anyway, you know, McDonald's All-Americans, and now the floor is shaking. So what else do we got to deal with? So, no, I thought that was always kind of a cool, you know, one of the things where you're like, I don't know if everyone understands this watching on TV that the floor is actually shaking.
Yeah. Well, I guess in Palo Alto, Coach, you don't know if that might be an actual earthquake, right?
So yeah,
you got to figure that out.
Could be.
Seismic activity. How do you go about selecting team captains? What does that process look like?
Well, you know, a couple different ways, but one way I found that fit our program real well is we talked about our core values for our program. You know, what were our core values for our program? And really define those and even having your players understand those and maybe even be in that process. But once those core values are established, talking to our team about who best exemplifies those core values on and off the court, not just who's our best player, but who exemplifies, you know, whether it's our four core values or six or seven, whatever those are, but who best exemplifies that on and off the court, and taking time to really think about that. And then I would ask players to nominate other players. And then based on those nominations, like basically votes, then our coaching staff would vote and go from there. Because I think when you look at it that way, and it's not a popularity contest, you know, and a lot of times you're, I think if your best player is your best leader and your best teammate, you're going to have a pretty good program. But there were times where maybe one of our best players wasn't someone that received multiple nominations or even was nominated, you know, or you might find out who you really feel like in the locker room, you know, is emulating those core values, or even in the classroom or off the court or on the weekend. So, you know, really trying to ask them to be honest with themselves about those things. And then obviously as a staff, and, you know, what you've seen from that point and then those captains. But, you know, I've always been, you know, big on our seniors, whether they're a captain or not, having a leadership role in our program. Because if it's not important to them, is what I would tell them. Why would it be important to a sophomore, or junior, or freshman who think their best basketball is ahead of them? You know, and there were times where we've had really good seniors in our program. And, you know, as an underclassman, you got to understand that you may not play again with a player like that. That kid that's a senior that's really, really good. We may not be at that level, like getting to that, you know, achieving that success. So every year needs to be, you know, relish that opportunity and be grateful for it. But I think those seniors need to make sure that everything they're doing is an example to those younger players, even your JV and your freshmen, that how important it is and what an honor it is to be a varsity, you know, team member and being a senior on varsity.
Do you give, or did you give your team captains any specific roles or responsibilities?
A lot of times they were really, whether it be sometimes team communication, you know, if we had a change to something, or what they were going to wear dressed to school on a game day. You know, there were times where they would lead us in drills, or, you know, when we got to an away game, you know, hey, this is, instead of having to go over like, hey, this is our culture and this is what we do when we're on the bus or when we get to a visiting arena, like those guys were the ones that would say, this is what we're doing, or this is what we're wearing, you know, that kind of thing. And just making sure that guys understood those types of things. I think, you know, recursive leadership is the best for me when they hear it from other people, and they see it. When they see a senior that grabs the ball bag or grabs the med kit and carries it on the bus or cleans up the bench after a game, I just think that says it all. It isn't, to me, being a senior isn't telling a freshman what to do. It's setting the tone and leading the example. So when you leave, you know that group next year is going to take care of it and treat it the same way you did.
You worked with a lot of teams, a lot of different personalities. Do you have a favorite activity that kind of helped bring your team together, team bonding type of activity that kind of helped build cohesion within your team?
You know, one thing I did at Portland State, and I did it again at Valley, was, again, I think just getting to know each other and your kids, your coaches, but would have each person kind of interview everybody, each other, you know, and then we'd share. But two of the things on there, a lot of it was, you know, brothers and sisters, you're going to get to see those people at games, but, you know, and sometimes everybody's situation can be different. But I would, two questions I always thought were pretty cool that I came up with that I kind of liked, and I thought the kids liked too, was, what's your go-to meal if you have to cook? So everybody's got something. If the chips are down and you got to make them, and the range was pretty crazy. I mean, from, you know, mine was hot dogs on the grill with mac and cheese to somebody that's making a full on, you know, spaghetti dinner, you know? And so, but just something like that because I think it's fun. And then also I would ask, what's your shining moment? What's your one shining moment to this point in your life? Like, what, tell me something that I don't care if you kicked a field goal in Pop Warner that won the game. What's your one shining moment? And, you know, I always thought that was, I'm a loved one shining moment. I always like to have kids think about that too. You know, what's the success that you have? It doesn't have to be basketball, but with something else that you could tell me about.
I like it. And then, Coach, I think the last question I had for you, which you might have answered already, was what's your favorite drill? You talked about high ball screens. If your manager go with the left, which is hard to get sometimes. So sometimes you have to bug your managers too, you know.
We would work on that. You know that. I enjoyed drills that would get guys talking, communicating, and passing the ball. So early in practice, whether it's even three-man weave, five-man weave, but just getting guys bowling and talking. I think sometimes the simple drills get kind of pushed out of there. You know, I love even 5-on-4 shell. I love because it puts you at a disadvantage and you can see who covers for other people, who can cover, who can make multiple plays, and who talks. You know, you have to communicate in something like that. But even those simple passing drills, you know, getting up and down the floor, who can handle, you know, going full speed and making a layup, and who takes pride in that. And so, you know, just kind of those energizer, getting started to practice with, you know, communication, energy, and doing it the right way.
Yeah. That's the tone, right? That's the tone for the rest of practice, for sure.
Definitely.
All right. Well, Coach, I think that's all I have for you today. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. I really appreciate it.
You're my pleasure, Derek. Always great to catch up with you, and I appreciate all you're doing for the Oregon basketball coaches and all the OVCA does. I think it's a tremendous organization, and just really proud of you as well.
Thank you, Coach. Appreciate that. If you have any follow-up questions or want to get a hold of Coach Sabaka, you can find his contact information in the episode description. We hope you'll join us next time here on the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. Until then, coach him up.
Thank you for listening to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. Is there a coach you'd like to hear from or a topic you'd like to hear us discuss? You can write us a message on the Anchor website or send us an email at OregonBasketballCoaches@gmail.com. You can also subscribe to this podcast on Spotify.